Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Forma on the Searcy Institute Podcast Network is brought to you by the Classic Learning Test, a classically based alternative to the SAT and ACT, which is the fastest growing college entrance exam in America today. More than 90 colleges now accept the CLT, and many of these colleges have endorsed it as their preferred admissions test. Students benefit from same day test results and can share their scores with colleges for no additional charge. To learn more or to register, head over to cltexam.com. That is cltexam.com.
Hello and welcome to the Searcy Institute Podcast Network. This is Andrew Curran speaking, and today we have with us a wonderful guest named Buck Holler. Buck, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I'm good because I get to talk with you. Buck and I go back. This is Andrew Curran. I don't know if I mentioned that, but Buck and I go back all the way to 2006, 2007, when the Searcy apprenticeship was a little wild puppy running around the living room and making a mess everywhere it went. And Buck got on board and became one of our leading lights in the apprenticeship program. Over the next 3 or 4 years, we made enormous gains. The puppy grew up into something like an adolescent dog, and Buck helped to tame it, to train it. And now Buck actually is the head mentor of an apprenticeship. How's that going, Buck? Do you like doing that?
Yeah, it's great. It's a new step, and I'm having a good time doing it.
Good. Well, one of the things that's right at the heart and soul of the apprenticeship, which is at the heart and soul of the Searcy Institute, is this notion of teaching mimetically, kind of a strange term considered from one angle, but at the heart of teaching mimetically is a very simple concept called a type. And today, that's what we're going to talk about, is the type. But before, I wanted to introduce you just a little bit more. Buck is the academic dean and Latin teacher at Christ Covenant in is it Wintersville, North Carolina?
Winterville.
So you only have one.
If you're a local, you say Winterville. Winterville.
Okay. I get that. Okay. And then he also has a wife and 3 children. Tell us about your family, Buck.
My family, well, my wife and I have been married for about 22 years now, and the children are growing up. My oldest is 20, and she's been studying something called permaculture, which she's been going through and getting certified in. And my middle child, we brought her home this last year to homeschool her. I do that. I work with her at home. And then our youngest is growing up. She's getting ready to enter into 8th grade. And we live here on a little farm where we raise chickens, turkeys. I'm getting into bees, so I have a lot of beehives now that I run, making honey.
And is that to attack your neighbors with in case they threaten you?
Yeah. The neighbors are pretty good. So
Good. Well, one of the things, Buck, I don't know if I've ever told you this to your face, and since we're on a podcast, I can tell it to you over the air. But one of the things I've always admired about you so much is how extremely skilled you are hands-on. Buck actually did ride in the rodeo when he was younger. He grew up farming. He is a very skilled farmer. This idea that his daughter is going into permaculture makes total sense to me. And the land has always been a big deal to you. And at the same time, how many people have I met in my life that have a good grasp of Hebrew, a decent grasp of Greek and are almost fluent in Latin? So how do you balance this physical with this linguistic or intellectual life? How do you do that?
That's great. I've always loved studying, and well, I shouldn't say always. Once I got out of high school, I traveled around. I guess I took a long gap year, about 4 or 5 years, where I traveled the rodeo circuit. And I had a four or five year gap year.
I like that.
Yeah. I had a love of horses. My dad taught me that. And I had always been involved with horses, training professionally and then also with rodeo. But I got back when I came out of that. I went back to school around the age of 22 when I first married, and I fell in love with studying. And during that time, I had a professor who ignited, I guess, or fanned the flame of languages for me. He was my Hebrew teacher. But being married with children and working full time and trying to make it through school, I spent a lot of time being sedentary, right? Sitting down and studying. And for me, I just got to get up and move. And so I always liked working with my hands, and I like working outside. I like building things. I worked for a time as a carpenter. I went to school for welding. And so I don't know. I just always had a knack and an appreciation for being able to do things with my hands. And I feel like it's a good balance. It's sort of the Latin phrase, as you know, mens sana in corpore sano, right? So a sound mind and a sound body. And so I just feel like the physical activity helps balances the mental activity.
What about a guy like me who has neither a sound mind nor a sound body?
Well,
what do I do?
The unfortunate thing is you only have one life. So
it's about over, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you take small steps. Okay. You do something, right? You do something.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little jealous because one of the things it takes to live that kind of life is some degree of stability and staying in place. And one of the things that you've done well is found spots and then stayed there and improved them. And I think in that sense, you are in an image. You are yourself a type of the sort of crunchy con, the person who's morally grounded, whose life is lived in the intellectual and moral traditions of the Christian church, but at the same time aren't intimidated by the environmentalists and people like that, because that's nothing new. It's not like for the first time in history we've determined that the environment matters because you live in it. And I think you're a well-rounded person. And so I just want to express that to our listeners, because what we're going to talk about in this podcast, as I mentioned, is the whole idea of types. And I indicated earlier that we place a strong emphasis on what we call mimetic teaching, and that in mimetic teaching, the type is a critically important element. So what am I talking about? What's mimetic teaching and what's a type?
Well, that was one of the things that led me to Searcy, honestly, was the question that I had was twofold. What is classical education, or, you know, classical Christian education? And then the second one was, how do we do it? And I felt like it was easy enough to pick up the literature and get a basic grasp of what it was. But the question was how to do it. And so that was why I joined the apprenticeship, was to learn, if I understand what Christian classical education is, then how do I actually teach classically? How do I teach in a way that honors the way that we learn? And and that was through the apprenticeship we discovered, what I came to discover, what we were taught was the classical rhetoric through the Lost Tools of Writing. And that became a medium for mimetic teaching, which mimetic teaching is as we describe it and define it, is a mode of teaching that, the word is based on the idea of imitation. So the imitation of what? Well, the imitation of truth, ultimately, right? Imitation of the Logos, Christ. We say the imitatio Christi. But what does that mean in terms of teaching a lesson, say, in composition, in Lost Tools of Writing? What does it mean in terms of teaching a lesson on, say, metaphors, or on what an amplification is, or how to define a term? And so the idea is being able to imitate that. And we do that through these different stages, and we move, as I like to say, we move from an initial perception, being able to perceive or see the idea, the logos of a lesson, to imitating it. So we move in this trajectory from perception to imitation. And there's a process that we go through in order to do that.
You mean the student moves that, or the teacher, who moves from perception to imitation?
Well, the student in the classroom is the teacher teaches, but I think that the teacher also has to do it as well, right? Mm. Because the teacher, this is where I like to refer to something I call breathing, because this is what I get in. If you go to Genesis 2, and you look at the event that takes place there, where God takes and forms man out of the dust of the earth, and then he breathes into him, into his nostrils, and he becomes a living soul, right? And so in that moment that man breathes, right, notice that it's God who is exhaling. And God's exhaling, the spirit of God is exhaled from God, and man inhales. And so there's this process of inhaling and exhaling, right, breathing. And so one of the things, though, I think that is essential for teachers particularly is the inhaling, right? Teachers have to breathe as well. And if all the teacher is ever doing is exhaling, is just breathing out, is just, and never inhaling themselves, then the teaching isn't as, how should we say, the teaching isn't as rich as it could be, right? The teacher is sort of short-circuited. So before a teacher can lead a student to imitate, you know, moving from perception to imitation, to go through that process mimetically, I believe the teacher has to as well, right? The teacher has to also have taken time set aside to be able to breathe, to be able to inhale, to be able to perceive and contemplate and come to understand and behold the idea, so that they can imitate it, so that the act of teaching is itself the teacher imitating the idea. The teacher then is providing a type, right, for the student as well, so that the student now is able to look upon that and see it and begin to draw from it.
Wow. So I got to pause you for a second. You've given us a really great picture, the picture of breathing, inhaling and exhaling, the need to inhale. And then you've also given us a very abstract way of putting it. You've talked about an initial perception going on and becoming an imitation. And then you said that the teacher has to imitate the idea. Imitating an idea, that's a really odd thought at first. Don't we imitate like movements or actions? So a person wants to learn how to play basketball, and he doesn't sit and imitate an idea. He imitates a move. A person wants to learn how to swim. He imitates a stroke. A person wants to learn how to dance. He imitates a step. What do you mean by imitating an idea?
Well, yeah, the idea, I guess the to explain that, an idea sits behind everything. So, I'm trying to think of the best way to go about this, to look at it. So if you think of maybe some of the things that you mentioned were skills.
Uh-huh.
There is that sense in which there's a skill that we're mimicking, a movement, a motion that we copy, we imitate. But that movement, that action itself is a physical embodiment of an idea of some kind. So,
okay. So let's take you back to the rodeo or to your farm. You're trying to plant, you're trying to grow a tree, or you're trying to tame a horse. Okay. What would be one action you would do if you're taming a horse?
Well, one of the first things is we go to the round pen. And one of the things I began teaching the horse to do is to trust you. So in order to do that, you ask the horse to do certain things. So let's say I just start by having the horse run in certain directions in the round pen, perhaps, or to take a saddle, or to maybe, how about turn or stop or any of those kind of actions.
Okay. So let's just pick one of those. The most intriguing to me is taking a saddle. Okay. So what you're saying is the action embodies the idea, and you use the phrase, you're teaching the horse to trust you. Am I hearing you correctly then that the act of taking a saddle embodies the idea that the horse should trust you, or that you are trustworthy maybe?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, if we stick with this example of horses, so in any interaction that you have with an animal, with a horse, for instance, there has to be a two-way, it's a relationship between the animal and you, and both of you have to have trust. And in order for you to do things to the horse and ask the horse to do things for you, that you've got to have that trust. And there's a number of different steps. You know, the horse has got to be willing to realize that the saddle's not scary. And they've got to learn to quell the fear that they might have of something new, right? Mm-hmm. This is uncomfortable to them. They've never had this experience, and they don't know how to.
Sorry to interrupt you, but it sounds like you're teaching the horse a lot of ideas. Also, yeah. There's clearly nothing in this that relates to children, because obviously the relationship element is not important with children. The idea of trust.
I might say that I've been teaching for a long time, but I've only been teaching humans for about 15, 16 years. But yeah, the round pin, I don't know. The round pin was sort of my first classroom, and it's, you learn a lot from that, I think. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to freeze you right there. I want to hold that thought. Okay. We've been talking about a horse learning from you. Now you said you learned a lot from the round pen.
Yeah.
Okay. Apparently things that you bring into teaching. Are you saying that when you were teaching horses in the round pen, mm-hmm. are you saying that you in that experience were learning ideas, and that those ideas now are things that you can apply in other contexts besides the round pen?
That sort of this transference of under knowledge or understanding, that I can take knowledge or skills that I've learned in one arena and move them into another arena.
Absolutely.
I mean, probably. So the thing I think of the most that I learned the most is that out of the hundreds of horses that I worked with, no two were alike. Every single horse was different. They were all horses, but every single one of them had a different composition, disposition. And so one of the things I had to learn was, okay, ultimately I had a goal. My trainer said, this is what I want. I want X, Y, and Z from these horses, and you need to tell me when they're ready. And so that was the goal. That was the standard, right? That I was having to get the horse to that point. But I couldn't do it the same way on every horse. So sometimes, you know, so I might try one technique or one way of trying to teach the horse how to do this particular skill, but it might not work on the same way on a different horse. I might have to actually go about it in a different way. And so, or it may take me longer. One horse may take less time. And so I had to learn to adapt my own instruction, my own training based on the horse. And so I had to read the horse a lot. And so the thing about that is that what it taught me was that, and this is where I get out of the Phaedrus. Plato talks about in the Phaedrus, he says that it's the responsibility of the teacher to know the soul of the individual person and to fit what the teacher says to the soul of the one whom he's speaking with, right? So you have to, it's more than just, it's not just a horse, it's not just an animal, it's not just a child, right, in your class. It's not just a warm body in a seat. They actually have a soul, and the responsibility of the teacher is to be able to perceive and understand the nature of that soul and know how to fit the word to the action, right? Hamlet, suit the action to the word and the word to the action, and overstep not what the overstep, not the boundaries of nature. Right.
Don't teach a horse like it's a dog.
Yeah. Don't teach a horse like a dog, but understand too, that it's not a factory, right? It's not, you don't just do 1, 2, 3 and everything comes out the same on every single animal, right? On every single horse. You can't, you got to understand, it might take you longer. It might take less time. It might take more time to do something to accomplish what you're trying to do. You might have to go about it in a different way.
Well, you're making
this. It's a basic skill I brought into the classroom, I think, you know.
But that's scary, Buck. What I'm trying to get at here is more of a comic book version of how this all works. And you're getting all deep and nuanced. Because what I'm, okay, here's what's going through my mind. We're talking about types.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm not sure that we've made it obvious that we're talking about types. So let me ask you this. You said what you learned the most is that of the hundreds of horses you taught, they're not all alike. Okay. All right. Now here's my question. Well, let me put it this way. It sounds to me, that's an idea. Hundreds of horses are not all alike. Would you agree that that's an idea?
Sure.
Simply in the most general sense of an idea. Okay. Now, you came to understand that idea experientially, right?
Correct.
In other words, you could have read that in a book, but you wouldn't have known it.
Correct.
What made that real knowledge to you as opposed to an abstract idea that you found on a piece of paper?
See, this is something, let me throw this out to you and see what you think, though. And my immediate response to that is that I played with it, right? Is that I spent time in the round pen doing it, playing with it, handling each horse, working with them. And the reason why I say play with it is because, and see if I can draw this connection to types. One of the things that I see a lot, and one of the things I've even, you know, I've done myself in the classroom, it being pressured with time, is in terms of teaching, sometimes we talk about types and we might understand them or might have heard the term sort of examples, like give an example. You might think of that in terms of math, like here's one math example, here's another example, or here's one horse, here's a second horse, here's a third horse, right? So and oftentimes in the teaching of that, we give a student a lot of examples, we give a student a lot of types, right? And we still haven't really, I don't know, fully define what we mean by the type yet, but we give them all of these types, all of these examples, and then we say, okay, now go do it. Or we say, here is what the lesson is. Like the teacher might define it. So I watched a lesson recently where a lesson is being taught where the teacher in a math class is talking about the way to solve different kinds of squares. There are perfect squares and different squares, and so the teacher throws up some problems that has some math problems that shows the differences of squares when you solve out these equations, like 2x plus 3. In parentheses next to another set of parentheses of say 2x minus 3, right? And so how do you work that problem? And then there is another set of problems of perfect squares. And so now the teacher gives that, and then the teacher says, okay, so here's the difference. The difference between these two examples is you can always do this with this one and this with this one, or something like that. And so now here are some other problems and you can go do them or on your homework tonight or work it. But see, the thing about that is what I'm getting at is that the students, I don't feel like were ever really allowed to play with those types. They were never allowed to sit there and handle them and play with them. In other words, instead of allowing the student to handle it, to throw it around, to look at it, to try to get frustrated by not being able to solve it, or being able to solve it and then being asked, what was different between this one versus this one over here? So what was the difference between this set of squares versus this set of squares? And allow the student to be able to hint. So like, what's the difference between this particular horse and this particular horse, right? And how can we still achieve the goal that we're trying to achieve? And so the student, and so that's what I mean by playing with it. So I think that the answer to the question was what helped me, what enabled me to understand was giving me time and space, right? Inside the classroom, inside the round pin, to actually play with the animal in order to figure it out. You know, I guess it might be put it that way. You know, you just got to get out and wrestle with it.
To get to know it.
Get to know it and figure it out.
And so then a horse, a particular horse, is an example of a horse, right? And a particular math problem is an example of a math concept. So the idea of a horse, the idea of a math concept, a square in that case, is embodied in these types. And it sounds to me like you learned two things at least. I mean, thousands, but two things that are interesting for this conversation that strikes me is that one is you learned in a way that I will never understand. You learned what a horse is, not a dictionary definition, but you learned what a horse is because you handled hundreds of horses. I see them on TV. That's what a horse is to me. And then secondly, not only did you learn what a horse is, what is always true of a horse, but you also learned how very different horses can be. And so you have both a firm understanding of the idea of horse and a very flexible understanding of what's contained in that idea of a horse. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So the varieties of the various natures of a horse, perhaps. Yeah.
And yet they all have the one shared nature. So within, so you could almost say that to define, which means to set a limit, right? To define is to put a word, to put a concept in its corral. And in that corral, you let that word have a lot of movement. But outside that corral, outside that round pen, it's no longer the same thing anymore. So it's not that when you define a word, you've described exactly what something is under every circumstance, but you've identified the limits within which it still is that thing. Mm-hmm. That seems significant to me because what you said earlier is that there's initial perception which moves to imitation. And we talked about skills, we've talked about ideas. When we talk about types, we're talking about some specific perception, right? The point of a type is that you perceive it. You've talked about it as examples. Is there any other kind of type that you can use as a teacher besides examples of something?
Any other kind of type that you can use?
For example, get it? For example, okay, you've talked about horses and then I'm taking them as examples of horses. You've talked about how another thing you said you learned was adaptation. Okay. You learned to adapt because you had hundreds of examples of adapting. That's how you get good at adapting, right? Okay, mm-hmm. But you also talked about how teaching is like breathing. Now, is breathing an example of teaching? Or is it a picture?
I don't know if I would say it's an example of teaching. I would say that it's a principle of teaching.
Could it be a picture?
You could say it that way, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, what do you mean by a picture?
Thank you. I mean, a metaphor, an illustration.
Yeah, of teaching. Of sound teaching, perhaps. Yeah, that a picture. What does sound teaching look like? You might say, well, it looks like this. Sure.
Okay. I guess what I'm wondering then is that another kind of type? If on the one hand you have examples of a math problem of a horse that helps you see the idea of a math concept or a horse or horseness. Is it necessary sometimes for us not to have examples to come to understand something, but to have pictures. Because here's why I'm thinking that. You used the word like breathing. I think you did anyway. And used it and talked about Genesis 2. You also said this is mimetic teaching. Mimetic is imitation. Imitation is when something is like something else. I've also heard it described as parabolic teaching. And a parable is when you have a picture of something that represents something that really without the picture, you'd have a hard time understanding. So the parable of the prodigal son, the parable of the sower going out to sow. It's not that the sower planting seeds is an example necessarily. It might be in some mystical way, but it's not necessarily an example of the word of God being planted, but it's a picture of it. Is that a type? Is a picture also a type, or does it have to be an example?
Well, some of it may be the word example. I mean, it almost sounds as if we're distinguishing using example more like a movement or some kind of a skill, whereas a picture might be something that's not necessarily movement. I don't know if I would limit example to something like a movement. You might say that if you're talking about, I mean, since we're using the word picture, let's talk about art. And you might say, well, let's look at, impressionist art. And you might say, well, here are multiple examples, but they're all pictures, right? They're all art pieces. They're not necessarily, or a type of literature or poetry, right? Romantic poetry. And we might have a lot of poems, but we're not. Maybe I'm not fully understanding, but I don't know if I would say that a type has to be, it's not just an action. It's not, right. I guess.
I think I confused that. This is what I mean. An example would be an instance of an actual thing. If I want to know what horse is, then I need to see a horse. And a horse would be an instance. A horse would be an instance of horseness, if you like. Okay, that it would be an example of. In math, if I want to teach my child that 3 + 2 = 5, I'm going to give him an instance of 3 + 2 = 5. Okay, 3 teddy bears and 2 teddy bears is 5 teddy bears. That's an instance of it. That's an example of 3 + 2 = 5. Okay, it's not like 3 + 2 = 5. It is 3 + 2 = 5. But if, on the other hand, I want to teach my child that he should share, I could give him an example of sharing by sharing, okay? An instance of it. I could share something, and that would be a good way of teaching my child to share. But I don't like sharing, so I prefer to use fables. So right. What I could do is give a picture, an illustration of sharing or the need for sharing, a story, right? Which contained in a story could be an example of the thing I'm trying to show. But basically, a fable, a fairy tale is going to be a picture of something that might be harder to see. Now, that might in fact be confusing because of the fact that a story will often include an example, and thus it undercuts my point. More to the point, or a better illustration of the point I'm trying to make might be, again, a parable of our Lord, who, like I said, with the parable of sowing the seeds, he's not giving an example of teaching the gospel when he says the sower went out to sow. He's giving a picture of it. It's like when you share the gospel, but it's not the same thing. An example is the same thing. An illustration is a different kind of thing, but it's like it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
And if that's the case, what I'm wondering then is does that mean there's two different kinds of types? There's types that are specific examples, and then there's types that are illustrations of something that needs to be learned.
So it sounds like a type of an illustration in the school, you know, maybe like how we teach literature. So, I mean, that's where my mind's going is approaching literature, approaching stories. And so when we may be teaching in certain, So these become types, right? The stories that we, you know, what books, what stories are your children or my children reading, you know, is that what you're saying here?
Well, probably what I'm trying to get at is more comic book than that, more caricature than that.
Sure.
What I'm trying to get at is something really, really fundamental and basic, that every time a person learns something, it seems to me, and I'm asking if you agree with this, every time a person learns something, he learns an idea because he sees the idea embodied in a type.
Right.
And sometimes that type is a example of the thing he's trying to see or that he comes to see. It's an example. And sometimes it's not an example. Sometimes it's an illustration. Sometimes it's a parable. So literature then, usually, literature is not true. I mean, right? It's not meant to be about a real person who actually did something. We don't know that Jesus is telling us about an actual prodigal and older brother who went out and did something. We don't know their names, right? It's an illustration of a spiritual truth. Nathan tells David a parable, mm-hmm, about the shepherd, right? It didn't, so far as we know, that didn't actually happen, but it made a spiritual truth to David. And so sometimes,
I hear what you're saying, but how do you make what's the difference between an illustration and an example? I know you've already stated it.
Okay.
I'm thinking of the David and the Nathan, you know, when Nathan goes to instruct David, right? To help him see what it is that he's done, because he knows what he's done, but he's not really seeing it, right? And in order to get him to do that, seek direction out. Instead of looking directly at it, he looks at it through the parable. And now David's able to understand. So Nathan goes about approaching it in that way. And I think you're rightly calling this, so that's an illustration of this idea of injustice, right? Mm-hmm. Perhaps, mm-hmm, that is going to help David see the injustice that he's done, to make that connection. But now he could give so as opposed to that, what would it look like if he gave him an example? What would be the alternative?
Yeah, he could have told him about a king who wanted somebody else's wife. So he had that king commit adultery with that wife and then kill the wife's husband by sending him into battle. It would have been a direct look. Here's what you did.
A direct look, yeah.
It's direct versus indirect.
So that's kind of that's one basic distinction, is one's far more direct or literal, maybe, mm-hmm, if we could use that term, versus one being less direct or not, more indirect and maybe
analogical.
Analogical, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
What?
Analogical, that's a big word.
Oh. Well, I mean that it's an illustration and not the actual thing. The wonderful thing about this is that this is how we learn, Buck. Okay. And I love the way you put what Nathan was trying to do with David. He was trying to help him see it, right?
Right.
What we're trying to do in math class, we're not just trying to teach the kids a technique. We're trying to help them see. When we're teaching literature, we're not just trying to teach them reading techniques. We're trying to help them see. You see? Mm-hmm. And in that, we're imitating the scriptural pattern. So here's what I would suggest. I want to teach teachers to help students see. Okay. So the idea that I want a teacher to understand is, when you teach, you help a child see. Okay. Now, how am I going to show a teacher that? Well, one way would be I could put the story of Nathan and David in front of them and say, let's look at this as though Nathan is a teacher. What's Nathan trying to do? What does Nathan do? Well, what Nathan does is he gives him a parable, gets him to look at it, forces him to look at it because it's irresistible. Compare and draws it, by the way, from David's own experience, his own childhood as a shepherd and so on, his own cherishing of a sheep, in knowing what a sheep can mean to a person. He touches David in the heart, and David sees what Nathan wants him to see because Nathan made it vivid and he made it memorable. When we teach math, we should make it vivid and memorable so that they can see it with their souls. When we teach literature, we should help them to see what's there by making it vivid and memorable. And what is it we're making vivid and memorable? This is what it seems to me, is a type. Okay. Now, sometimes that type is an example, and sometimes that type is an illustration. But the glory of that is that if it's an example and it's vivid and memorable, then they see it and remember it. If it's an illustration, did I just say that? If it's the other, then and we make it vivid and memorable, and it's a good illustration, an accurate illustration, then they'll see it. And so what the go ahead.
I was just had a question, but if so, the I was wondering. It sounds, but you want them to look at that first, right?
To look at the picture, to look at the thing. Yes,
exactly. It's important to look at the picture. Like Nathan didn't ask David to figure out what it is that he's done. He's sitting there. He wants him to look at the story first.
Yes,
you know, and don't. It's like, you know, I think I've heard you say, you know, low hanging fruit, right? Let's not, we don't need to go deep. That's right now. Right. We need to let's look at the surface. Let's look at what's in front of us. Let's look at the type. Yes. Don't try to get behind the type and try to figure it out.
Look at the type, not the idea. Thank you. Look at the type, not the idea. Because if you look at the type and you look closely at the type, and then, if necessary, you look at another type and you look closely and you compare the types, you will see the idea. And that's what I was going to go ahead.
Yeah. And this is exactly what I was thinking of too, because that, and that's one of the things we've talked about with teaching children to read and to write, is let them ask any question they want of the story. It doesn't matter what question they ask, right? Of whether somebody should have done something, it's going to take them into the heart of the story. Right. Into the logos of the story. One of the fears I think that as teachers that we have is that if I let the student play too much with the types, I'll lose control. Like the lesson will go awry. They won't get it. We'll miss the point. But if the types are sound, if the types are truly embodiments of the idea that you're trying to teach, you can let them play with them all day long. You'll never get lost.
That's right? Absolutely because right.
Because they'll always come back, because every single type is going to come back and point to the idea that you're teaching.
Yeah, and you've pointed out something else too, that what we're emphasizing here is ideas. We want the student, as Nathan wanted David to see the moral of the story, if you like. So we're talking about the idea. I talked about horse, right? You want to see the idea of horseness. We've talked about math. You want the child to see the idea of the math. Now, what's crucial here is idea is not the same thing as what we normally think of as content, okay? And what gets us stressed out as teachers is when we worry about the amount of content that our children learn. And the irony is that if you teach a child to read a book looking for types, in other words, like you said, you ask, what character is there and should he have done it? What did he do? Should he have done it? Or what should he do? Okay. Those kinds of normative questions drive them into the heart of the text and make them remember the content better, because it makes the content vivid, which is a way of saying living, and memorable. Whereas if you just worry, oh, my child has to learn this content, he has to read so many books and so on and so forth, what's going to happen is he's going to be so concerned about grading, getting grades on about content, that he's not going to learn how to see ideas, which means he's not going to have his soul cultivated by the reading. And you brought up the word soul earlier. That's why I mentioned it here. It's so crucial that you have to cultivate the child's soul. And this is how we learn if what we want to learn is truth. In order to learn truth, we need to see the truth embodied. And that's why another term for this, sorry to go on so long, but another term for this is incarnational teaching. And what I would like to say is that the idea of teaching types is a thoroughly biblical idea, because when our Lord Jesus came, not only is he the incarnation of the Word, capital I, capital W, and in being the incarnation of the Word, he gives us the pattern for every lesson. Because every lesson then it has a word, right? I have a word for you today. Okay. Every lesson has its own word, small w. And the way you get the child to see it is with a small I incarnation of that word. Okay. So Jesus is the form of teaching, which gets me giddy to think about. Not only that, but when our Lord came, there had already been dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of intertwined types. And one of my favorite stories, I've probably told you this, and I'm going to pause after I say this story so you can talk and I can be quiet where I'm supposed to be. But one of my favorite stories is when I was a kid, I did Awana and we had tribe times where kids would memorize Bible verses. And this little boy had memorized the verse, "Behold the Lamb of God." And he recited it to me. And then I said to him, I think he was 7 or 8. And I said to him, "Why do you think John the Baptist called Jesus the Lamb of God?" And I'll never forget this. Do you remember the story, Buck?
Mm-hmm.
What did he say?
No.
Okay. So what the little boy said was, because he thought he was cute. Okay. So, huh. So I'm thinking that's not what John the Baptist disciples thought.
Right. Sure.
But why? Right? They didn't. Okay. This little boy thought Jesus was cute, or that John the Baptist meant Jesus was cute, because that was his experience of lambs. That the types of lambs, not examples probably. In other words, he probably didn't go on a farm and see examples of lambs. He probably had stuffed lambs, right? He had the types of lamb that he had encountered were not accurate and led him to conclude that they were cute. Meanwhile, John the Baptist, his disciples had seen lambs sacrificed morning and evening.
Yeah.
So when they heard Lamb of God, not because, notice this, neither of those people got a lecture. In both cases, the little boy and the disciples of John had seen types. They had seen so many types that they drew the conclusion that was entirely natural from the types that they saw. And that's what I think is a crucial point that we're getting at in this podcast, is that the quality of the type. And you can't help but teach with types, because that's how humans learn.
So maybe if I can draw us back full circle to where we began with the question that you were asking me about skills, because in this, what you're talking about with our Lord is reminding me of something else I was thinking about in terms of just thinking about types and Jesus. And one of my favorite texts is the Sermon on the Mount out of Matthew. And what's fascinating to me is the way in which it's structured. And after the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7, of course, you have all of the teaching, Christ's teaching, right? He's in chapter 4, ends where it's after he elects his disciples, and he says that he was going around teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all manner, you know, all diseases and illnesses. Mm-hmm. And then so now you have chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Jesus teaching, right? And then what happens in chapter 8? In chapter 8 and 9, Jesus then goes out and he begins healing, right? The kingdom of God. In other words, he's going out and he does, there's a number of events. And I was wondering as you were saying this, and is that not, because then what follows on that, after Jesus goes through and in multiple accounts heals different people and performs different miracles, in chapter 10, then he sends his disciples out. And so, well, I guess what I'm getting at is all of those acts, right, that Jesus was doing, that those are, you know, what was the idea behind all of those? Well, the idea he's proclaiming the kingdom of heaven, right?
Yeah, gospel of the kingdom. Beautiful.
This is the gospel of the kingdom of heaven. This is the gospel of the kingdom of heaven. So that's the idea behind it. And the actions, right, are suited to the word. The actions are suited to the idea that these are embodiments of the truth that Christ is proclaiming, and he's presenting them repetitively before his disciples in order to imprint upon their souls how they likewise ought to go out and do as he did, which he then calls them to do in chapter 10. So there's just this progression that moves from chapter 4 through chapter 10, where we see the multiplicity of types that Christ presents in his teaching of the disciples, right?
And reveals to them the kingdom of heaven in word and deed. I love that because the burden of it, of course, is that therefore, if I'm going to claim to be a preacher of the gospel, then it's simply not enough to preach the gospel in words because I will contradict those words in my actions if there isn't a coherence between them. And that's the same. Go ahead.
Well, that just brings up another topic, which maybe is a little bit longer, but it's the ethics of rhetoric, right? It's the knowledge when you come to behold or perceive an idea, there is a responsibility then that you have of that understanding. Yeah. And so once you come to understand truth or justice or love or charity, whatever it is, when you come to understand and see it, then there is this almost obligation that we have to preserve it, right? To honor it. And we honor it by allowing it to be, we honor truth when we're truthful. We yeah. honor love when we love, right? And so you can't just say it and not do it, right? The action is tied by an ethic, by a Christian ethic to the idea, right?
And then of course you bring that down to the daily lesson and the same thing holds true. It's not as important if they go wrong in math as it is in ethics, but if I want to teach my child 3 + 2 = 5, then I have to honor 3 + 2 = 5 in the lesson. And I have to embody it. I have to take the truth of 3 + 2 = 5, and I have to embody that with 3 teddy bears + 2 teddy bears = 5 teddy bears, or 3 ice cream cones + 2 ice cream cones = 5 ice cream cones, or whatever it is. I have to embody it. And the soul responds to that because, as I said, that's how we're created to learn. That is how we learn. And regrettably, Buck, we just ran out of time.
That's what I thought.
Closing comment. You get it.
Yeah, sure. I'll say that my Mimetic teaching has been revolutionary for me, and it's taken years of doing it and learning and growing in it and seeing the beauty of it. I'm glad that we had this talk because one of the things that oftentimes in learning mimetic lessons is this process where we have the types and we talk about comparing types. And I've often thought that there was sort of this, if there was a step that could be skipped, that was one of them. But one of the things that I've been realizing of late, and thinking about and contemplating a lot, it's like, if there's probably a step that's one of the most crucial steps, that's one of them, right? And it's the step that we rob our children of more than anything else by not allowing them to handle these things. And so I guess my closing comment is, and maybe admonition is as we learn to use types in our instruction and to find good types, is this the encouragement to let the students handle them, right? And because that's really where the impression begins to take place, I think, when the students really begin to be able to handle the types.
Metaphorically and literally. So sometimes they have to handle them, in other words, just think about them themselves instead of being told what to think. But they have to observe them. They have to roll them around in their own minds. Fantastic. So we got to end, but Buck, thank you. I hope we get to do this again. And if anybody wants to learn more about types or mimetic teaching, there's a lot of stuff on the Searcy website. You might be interested to know that Buck has produced a handbook of types to go with our Lost Tools of Writing. And that might be a very valuable resource for any of you that either want to learn more about types or about the Lost Tools of Writing, or that are using the Lost Tools of Writing. Well, I hate to rush off, but I have to. And so I offer you all my best wish, which is may the Lord remember you in his kingdom.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.